This is Dave Mitchell on Radioactive Magazine on KKFI. Today we're speaking with Ms. Pythia Pei, who is an author and journalist on psychology, spirituality, and the American psyche. She has received awards for her work from the American Association of University Women and Women in the Media. She has written extensively on the subject of various myths that comprise the American psyche, and we will be focusing on her new book, America on the Couch: Psychological Perspectives on American Politics and Culture. In her book, Ms. Pei shares her interviews with primarily Jungian psychoanalysts on the psyche of our nation. Ms. Pei, we greatly appreciate you sharing your time with us today on Radioactive Magazine, and welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. I'm happy to be speaking with you today. Okay. Thank you very much for having me on as a guest.
Okay, we're very pleased to have you as a guest. So, it is one thing to talk about an individual psyche. Can you talk about the concept of a culture having a psyche?
Yes. Well, I think that Carl Jung first turned us in that direction with his idea of the collective unconscious, that there existed a kind of dimension of reality, of myths and symbols and archetypes that influence human behavior, and that are found in the layers of each individual human psyche. And he also spoke about a national layer of the collective unconscious, so that countries have their own psyche, and in that psyche can be found all the myths and ideals and the history and the stories, the cultural beliefs and practices that make up a country.
And so a country's psyche is part of the overall, it is a manifestation of the overall human collective psyche. Is that correct?
Correct, right. Okay.
And there are certain fundamental archetypes that are fundamental to human psychology that each culture reflects in one way or another.
Exactly.
Okay.
I mean, and you can look at the hero archetype as an example of that, which is a universal archetype, but that gets expressed in American culture in very specific ways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you did say in your interview with Erel Shalit, an Israeli psychotherapist, that you made the point that the hero archetype is writ large in the American psyche. It mm-hmm. animates the telling of our history and operates as a background force in all of our lives. And do you want to say more about that and what his response was to that
yes.
statement?
Well, first I'll just say a little bit more about the hero and how it's so central to our identity as a nation. In an unpublished interview that I did with Jungian analyst Marianne Woodman some years ago, she told me a story about a trip she'd taken to historic Williamsburg and a film she'd watched while she was there about the American Revolution. And she is Canadian-born. And she described how moving it was and that she hadn't realized what tremendous courage it had taken for the early founders and revolutionaries to go through that very emotional break with their mother country, England. To risk their lives and the lives of their loved ones to win their freedom and then fight this war in which they were overwhelmingly outnumbered and outgunned, and then come together and then debate and articulate and organize and set up the world's first large functioning democratic government. So the qualities of the hero, that's a little historic background, the sheer physical courage and bravery in the face of great odds, the daring to break with the old and initiate a new way of doing things, standing up to injustice and oppression, are right there in the story of the very founding of our country. I sometimes think we forget actually how really brave they were, because many of them, the founders, those who signed the Declaration of Independence could actually have been hung as traitors if they'd been captured. So it's our heritage, and so it's written into our cultural DNA, and this kind of heroism is what gave us the courage as a nation to fight and win World War II, to survive the Great Depression, to go to the moon, and many other things. It's this emphasis, I think, on the heroic individual and the chance to make it on our own that draws immigrants from around the world to come here. So it's really the kind of column, the major, one of the standing columns of the American dream. So I'm an American, and I identify and I resonate with this myth of the hero as much as anybody else, in the sense that it can inspire us and give us courage as individuals to do all those things that the founders and revolutionaries did, to strike out on our own, to build our own life, to follow our own unique and individual path. But as Errol Shallett pointed out in our interview, and as others in my book pointed out as well, and I'll diverge here for just a moment and say a lot of what I did in this book was to go in and look at kind of the shadow side of some of our brighter myths that we hold up to the rest of the world, to look at the underside of that. And so one of the things that we talked about and that others also spoke about was this idea of the lone hero, that our hero is usually in our popular mythology, the cowboy on the horse, who kind of has climbed all, you know, who's struck out into the unexplored territory, or the mountain climber who's climbed the peak. We see this in our images of the cowboy in the Western frontier. So typically our American hero is a kind of rugged loner, like that iconic image of the rugged Marlboro man in the Western landscape, or the pilot Chuck Yeager when he's piloting the X-1 rocket plane to the edge of the atmosphere, becoming the first man to break the sound barrier.
John Wayne. Yeah.
Yes.
John Wayne.
And in one of my interviews, the psychohistorian, as you mentioned with John Wayne, he mentioned that in his work with Vietnam vets after the war, they also spoke about the way that American myth of the lone hero, particularly they referred to it as the kind of John Wayne complex, had driven them to sign up and go and fight that war. So that we have this bright spotlight on the lone individual hero. But what we don't see, first of all, is the shadow of the other people who stood around this hero, who helped him or her to climb that mountain peak to success and achievement. And if we look at the image of the cowboy, I mean, he's sitting on a horse. The horse, we have, which is emblematic of the natural world within which we're all connected and embedded. The land itself that surrounds him, which is not only for the taking or conquering, but the very land that will feed him and sustain his very life. There's the hero's partner, the husband or wife, the family who helps to take care of the more practical needs of that person's life, allowing them to be devoted to their pursuits, the secretary, the construction crews, you know, all the people who go in to help the heroic achievement take place. But I, in addition to that, and this is what I really got into more specifically with Dr. Shallett, and that was the emergence of what I think of as a new frontier in the American hero myth, something that's been the basis for all my work in bringing together politics and psychology, both in this book, America on the Couch, and also in my memoir, American Icarus, which is about my father. And that is the courage and the risk-taking and the heroism that's involved in inner psychological work. And the tremendous courage, and I think anybody who's gone into analysis knows this experience of what it's like for the first time to go in and face our complexes and our fears and our terrors and look at those less pleasant sides of ourselves, our projections, our prejudices, our places where we're selfish. So anybody who's been in therapy knows what that feels like. And also the places, and I think this is particularly difficult for the kind of iconic American, and that is to go also to connect with our wounded side of ourselves, these less than perfect sides of ourselves, parts of our lives where we don't function very well, where we're not very talented or gifted, where we're flawed, where we're afraid. For instance, I tell a story about my dad in my memoir, who flew dangerous missions during World War II in these very rudimentary airplanes over jungles and shark-infested oceans and through mountain peaks. And when he was dying, he talked about that and then spontaneously mentioned how frightened and scared he'd been, which was very unlike him. So Shalit, in my interview, named some of the shadow sides of the hero. He describes the enemy and the cripple and the beggar. And if you like, I can go a little more into detail about each one of these if I have time.
Well, I think before we get to that, I mean, I think to me, what a fundamental point I think you're making here is that the American hero myth, to the extent that we are attached to the American hero myth, we are missing some fundamental truths about what it is to be an interdependent culture. And, you know, that so there's a cultural dysfunction going on right now. And and you're about to describe those, actually, with the beggar and what were the other two? I'm sorry.
The beggar, the cripple, and the enemy.
Okay.
Yes, that's a very good way of putting it, that we are kind of dysfunctional in this area. And I think, so the enemy, as Shalit describes it in our interview, is the person that we project upon the person that we project our own disowned shadow side onto. Like we look across the street at the neighbor and we see our neighbor as shallow, or we don't admire them for certain specific reasons. And in the end, if we're really doing our inner work, we would have to examine and look at those sides of ourselves, or those parts of ourselves that we don't like so much. The cripple, in his book, he actually has a book called The Enemy, the Cripple, and the Beggar, which is what I turned to for our interview. And the cripple, as he speaks about it, represents those wounded parts of ourselves, as I mentioned, where we have limitations. And I think that that's always very hard as an American, to feel that there's some place where, and of course he's speaking psychologically, he makes a distinction, you know, between the actual person who might suffer from a physical disability. And he's speaking about the psychological parts of ourselves, and perhaps we're not able to. I can speak personally. I actually described a dream that I had in which there was a man dressed in 19th century clothes with a dark cloak, and I was riding with him in a taxi. And the reason I had this dream is that I have what I call my transportation complex, which is kind of a fear of taking the metro in the city where I live and going far distances. And I'd been invited somewhere that required me to take the metro and to change and to try and take Uber and all these different kinds of things. And I felt crippled in that way. And so when I had that dream about this person, this figure was a 19th century man, and he had a cane, and he walked with a limp so that he was wounded in one of his legs. And he was very compassionate to me and actually gave me some money to take a cab. And so that figure for me was very helpful in helping me to relate to some of the ways in which we might individually suffer from that cripple, that complex in our own psyche.
But how does, as far as our American collective psyche goes, how do our wounds show collectively? I mean, I can't help but think of the political polarization that's going on right now that just seems to be getting worse and worse. Do you think part of it, or?
Yes, I mean, I would have to think about that for a minute. I mean, I think what we feel, what I felt in myself individually, was a reflection in me of these cultural ways of looking at life, or cultural ideals of how we ought to be in America, which is bold, which is brave, which is that kind of hero who can just take on the world and do anything. And these are the darker sides of the cripple. And I think in terms of the American psyche and the cripple, the figure of the cripple, I think it's very, I would look more at it in terms of what happens to us when we suffer from an economic recession and when things don't go well for us in that sense. I think that's very crippling to our self-esteem.
Mm-hmm.
Because we like to think of ourselves as this great country that can do anything and can overcome anything. Our image of ourselves is of that courageous cowboy or soldier.
Uh-huh.
And so it's hard for us to take in being crippled economically, things that I think that would translate as poverty. I think that when veterans come back with post-traumatic stress syndrome, and I think in some ways it's veterans coming home psychologically crippled and physically crippled from the wars abroad, have maybe been a kind of leading force that, or a wedge that's making inroads into some of our stereotypes as we've been forced to kind of open our hearts and our minds and our wallets and our psyches to not only to the brave soldier, but to the crippled soldier.
Mm-hmm. And to the consequences of us acting out the American hero myth.
Exactly.
Right. One of your psychotherapists talked about how the things that people are afraid of, that the U.S. has lost its preeminence and collapses, that we're collapsing, and he said that it's already happened. And
I think you're referring to the James Hillman interview on that.
Yes,
yes.
And,
right.
And he also talks about how we're clearly a manic nation and we're a depressed mm-hmm. nation, but we don't admit it.
Yes,
can
I think,
you kind of expand on those themes?
Well, I think that when we, what he was saying is that, you know, these things that were not so great anymore, were not, the great I am, as June Singer talked about, the Jungian analyst June
uh-huh.
Singer had said in our interview. And he saw a symptom of that our inability to kind of come to terms with that was expressed in our kind of the way we're so manic, the way we're so driven. And I think so that we're going faster and faster and faster. And it reminded me a long time ago of an old movie, I don't know if you remember it, called Koyaanisqatsi, I think it was called.
I knew of that film. I don't think I ever saw it.
Well, I remember watching that, and that memory came back again as I was reading that interview with Hillman, and it was basically a Native American prophecy about Western civilization, and it had to do with the speeding up. And as we sped up, the speeding up was a symptom of our decay. So James Hillman talks a lot about, you know, how we see the fast cars and how even the music and the images on TV, everything just goes faster and faster. But I think that he says it's a defense, and that it's a defense against our depression. And it's a defense against the depression that we're feeling because we are sensing that on some level our country or our culture is kind of breaking down, and that the old ways of doing things aren't working for us anymore, and new ways, we're sort of in an in-between state, and we're waiting for these new forms to kind of bubble up. And so there's a lot of this causing a lot of anxiety in the American psyche and among the American people.
Well, I think James Hillman said that he pointed out that we were exceptionally backward in about 15 different categories, and that right. that we sort of we know that down deep inside, but we're in denial of that, and that we want to put things back the way that they were. I think the appeal of Donald Trump is that he talks about making America great again, and that he does appeal to a certain segment of the population that feels that they've lost their power.
And to go more, just to say more about the segment, who the Trump supporters are. They basically skew white, male, and poor. It's a demographic that it's very sad to read about that's also dying young. They're earning less than $50,000 a year, and they didn't go to college. And I think they're suffering from very real things like the effects of globalization and loss of manufacturing, which have led to a loss of the jobs that traditionally supported the demographic.
There's definitely a loss of security.
Loss of security and loss of identity, because that was always, you know, there's a wonderful quote from Abigail Adams in which she is on a ship with some English aristocrat who's kind of demeaning kind of America, and Abigail Adams kind of draws herself up and praises, you know, this country of what she calls husbandmen and farmers and tradesmen and builders. And that's always been a source of pride for us as a country. So the loss of those jobs and the pain and the loss of identity and economic security, but also just pride, being able to take pride in who they are, I think is a real psychological wound to the American psyche. And I think it's kind of tragic the way Trump is building on this. And I think he's playing to their fears by becoming, he is an authoritarian figure. He kind of puts himself across as he embodies that whole, I am the great America, and if you vote for me, I'll make America great again, and by extension, I'll make you great again, and strong again, like me. But, you know, he does this by also through, you know, playing on, you know, the fears of immigrants, which I think is really too bad.
Well, it's really quite tragic, actually, in my opinion. But also his proposal that we ban Muslims from immigration, and there is a quote from Thomas More that you interviewed on in your book America on the Couch, and it talks about how the narcissist closes himself off from the real world, living in a bubble of self-appreciation. He doesn't want contamination or complexity. He enjoys it when people are swayed by his posing and respect him for his ideals. But then eventually his shadow appears and people dislike him with an unusual intensity. And I couldn't help but think of Donald Trump when I read that.
Well, I think you're exactly right. But, and there have actually been many articles written about Donald Trump as being a classic, having a classic narcissistic personality disorder, and how he just fits all that criteria so perfectly. But I think the important thing to remember about a narcissist is that in the quote from Thomas More, he mentions the shadow of the narcissist. But there's always the wound within the narcissist, which the kind of sense of grandiosity and the inflation of his, you know, of him or her as a great, great person is kind of a cover or a decoy over this wounded side of themselves. I think often with the narcissist, there's a sense of emptiness and hollowness inside. And a lack of a strong identity.
Yeah.
And I wanted to say something about that in terms of how I think that actually reflects something, you know, Thomas More talks about the narcissism of America. Mm-hmm. And when you look at America's history, this is a problem for America because we ourselves lack, we don't have a long history. We're still a new country. And we lack a kind of strong cultural identity. We're made of all different peoples who've come together from the distant shores. We still haven't come to terms, I think, with some of the losses and the mourning around that, and that gets projected onto the new immigrant who comes over. Our own unmourned past, we haven't really looked at. And so I think because we're so new, we're so young, that it's a vulnerability for us, and we don't like to, we don't like to feel that vulnerability.
Right.
And so somebody like Donald Trump can come in and make up for that,
make
us feel strong.
Seem to be strong, but is actually not. And
right.
I'm getting the message that we have to end our interview now.
Okay.
I really. It's too bad. We could talk about these things for quite a bit longer. But you know, thank you very much for being on Radioactive Magazine with us today here at KKFI, our humble community radio station here in Kansas City.
Well, thank you. As a Kansas City native, I appreciate this opportunity very much.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for being on our show.
Okay.